On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Jean Burns discusses the relationship between physics and consciousness research.
Currently, non-physics is about matter. It's not about consciousness. If you talk about matter solely and the laws that govern matter, the whole universe is pointless. But that doesn't say that there's all that there is. Because, for instance, if you add consciousness and you add free will, which is a radical stand, but if you add free will, then you say, okay, there's something more.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with research experts and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and we're joined today by theoretical physicist and co-editor of the book Psi Wars, Dr. Jean Burns. Dr. Burns, welcome to Skeptico.
Hi.
Dr. Burns, I think you're the first physicist we've had on the show, and I was wondering if you could start by telling us a little bit about how that background informs your look into psi research.
Okay, well, I'm a theoretical physicist, and over the last 20 years, my interest has been especially in consciousness and psi and how it relates to physical laws. And I did my first article on that subject back in 1986, and in those days, it was still hard to publish articles on consciousness. It was just beginning to come out of behaviorism, and it was still difficult, although psi journals would take articles on consciousness. So I went on with that, and my focus has been that, well, there's two things to notice about mental action. One is that there's got to be some connection of consciousness to the physical world, so there's got to be points of similarity. And also, we know that some things are going to be different. And in fact, presently known physical laws have nothing to do with consciousness. So any addition that has to do with consciousness is going to be a radical extension of physical laws.
Could you expound on that a little bit? How do we know that the current physical laws, as we understand them, can't play a role in consciousness?
Well, they can play a role, but it's not going to be a complete one because the currently known physical laws don't mention consciousness. So something has got to be different. And there is the whole thing of what's going on now with respect to physical laws, because most people like to feel, well, we've got to add something to physical laws about consciousness, but maybe it's just a passive emergentism of consciousness. And you just say, well, add consciousness and you know, write your physical laws down and write off to the side plus consciousness and you're done. If consciousness is passive, then that's all there is to it. But if free will exists and if PK exists, then you've got to explain how consciousness is affecting the physical world in a way that isn't determined by known physical laws. And then you've got a radical extension. Most people who are in the subject of consciousness really are reluctant to believe that there could be that kind of radical addition to physical laws. And so they would rather say, well, free will is just an experience we have and there couldn't possibly be any psychokinesis because there would be too much addition to physical laws. This is basically the main argument of the skeptics. It's implicit usually. But when they say, well, psi can't exist, what they're saying is if it did exist, there would have to be this addition to physical laws, and I just can't believe that something like that could be happening.
If I could, I'd like to pick up on one topic you just touched on briefly, and that's free will. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, I think it's surprising to most people when they look into this field to really come to terms with the idea that, which is the predominant paradigm right now, that we do not have free will, that we do not really knowingly make decisions on our own, but that that process is somehow automated or completely handled by our biology. Can you maybe explain what's really going on there? What's our understanding of free will?
Most people who write about free will do a compatibilism stand, and they say, well, it's an experience that whatever free will is, it has to be compatible with physical laws, by which they mean presently known physical laws. And so it isn't really free will. And what they say is we're explaining free will. What they mean is they're explaining it away, actually. But they say, well, we're explaining free will. And as long as we're happy with the experience, we feel like we have it and we're happy to feel that way, that's all there is to it. But one of the arguments is that you wouldn't conserve energy, and there's a very interesting response to that. It was shown by a physicist, Ulrich Morhoff, in 1999, that the conservation of energy, which follows from deep level symmetries in physics, without trying to get into the technical details, that it's only necessary to conserve energy if you have a mathematical law describing the forces involved. So if free will is genuinely free, you don't need to conserve energy. There's nothing in physics that says what happens if something is genuinely free and not determined. So that really isn't a problem, although this knowledge of his findings on this doesn't seem to be very well known.
I think you're probably right, because from what I hear, the logical conclusion, well, and actually I interviewed Dr. Sue Blackmore, who you may know, as a researcher in consciousness, and recently published a collection of conversations and essays from a variety of researchers on consciousness. And let me play for you a clip from her, which I think is the end play, the end result of position that these folks wind up taking, and I'd like to get your comments.
We live in a pointless universe. We're here for no reason at all. There isn't a soul. There isn't a spirit. We're not going to live forever in some kind of heaven or something like that. And I think there are no paranormal phenomena, although I can't be sure about that, but I really think there aren't. Yet, we have extraordinary experiences.
Okay, and that was, again, Dr. Sue Blackmore. Any comments, Dr. Burns?
Well, I think what she says is delightful, actually. If it comes to what currently known physics says, remember, currently known physics is about matter. It's not about consciousness. But she's completely right. That's what I find so delightful. It's a statement of what physics shows. If you talk about matter solely and the laws that govern matter, the whole universe is pointless. There's no way to have any point to it because there's nothing to do with consciousness, which is how we would conceive of having some point. But that doesn't say that there's all that there is. Because, for instance, if you add consciousness and you add free will, which is a radical stand, but if you add free will, then you say, okay, there's something more. And whether the universe as a whole is pointless is kind of a theological subject, but you can at least say if we have free will, well, we can do our best to make at least our corner of the universe better as best we can. So the universe has some point in that sense. So if we have free will, or PK, in other words, mental action, we can do something. So then the universe isn't necessarily entirely pointless after all.
Okay. All right. You know, if I can, I'd like to move on to another subject and take advantage of the fact that I have a physicist on the show today. And I want to talk a little bit about quantum physics, quantum mechanics. And I'm sure as a professional in this field, you must sometimes cringe when you hear a New Age philosopher or some other guru talk about quantum physics and how it relates to consciousness. But there are questions. I certainly have them, and I think other folks do, in terms of what are the real connections or possible connections. So I wanted to talk about a couple of different areas and start with the observer effect. So could you take a minute and maybe briefly tell us what the observer effect is in simple terms? And then secondly, do you think the observer effect is coming into play in Psi research?
Well, the latter, the answer is too soon to know. But to go into the subject in general, there is in quantum mechanics this feature that quantum systems evolve ordinarily just in terms of what you call time-reversible laws. It's just a technical term of what things go on. And when you do a measurement, you jump from one state to another state with this jump or collapse of the wave function, as it's called, not being part of the rest of regular quantum mechanics, but this adjunct that's added on. And ever since quantum mechanics was first developed in the 1920s, it's been kind of a puzzle. Why do you need this adjunct? Well, it's not, in the first place, it's not clear that you need to have a collapse of the wave function actually in order to understand quantum mechanics. There's interpretations that don't use a collapse and get around it in other ways. For instance, David Bohm and Basil Hiley. And Roland Amnès, a French physicist, has developed extensively a model where the so-called collapse of the wave function is actually just a shorthand way of writing the change of going through the measurement. So there's a debate among physicists whether you even need to hold this concept of collapse of the wave function. I think it's fair to say it's not resolved at this point. They're still debating. But supposing there is such a thing as collapse of the wave function, then there's about six schools of thought of what it is. And without going into all the details, the observer doing the collapse is one of these six or so different interpretations. So this is popular in Psi. As I've said, if mental action acts in Psi to cause some effect on the physical world, then there has to be a point of similarity where this mental action connects to the physical world. It won't be the same, but it will be similar. And one possible point of similarity is collapse of the wave function. So there's various physicists at working in parapsychology who have suggested, well, it's this collapse of the wave function that produces PK. There's other ideas possible. For instance, I've got a theory out that says, well, PK acts within the limits of the uncertainty principle, and whether there is or is not an observer collapsing the wave function, the action of PK takes place a different way, which is just to say there's different types of theories, and there's no agreement on which one is right. But the observer theory may turn out to be the right one. It's too soon to know.
Great. You know, I think that's a very good overview of both how it looks from the perspective of theoretical physics, and then why it's a popular theory to be drawn into the whole Psi debate. That really helps. So let's move on and talk about the other aspect of quantum mechanics that we hear so much about, and that's entanglement and non-locality. Can you again tell us, and from what I understand, again, my physics background is rather limited, but that we could actually set up an experiment where I could come in and actually observe non-locality among non-locality happening, of splitting of two photons being in two places and seeing that. First of all, is that correct? And then secondly, in that process, maybe you could explain what it is, and then its appeal for Psi and whether we are close to understanding whether that has a role in Psi.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. You can set up a physics experiment and observe the phenomenon of non-locality. It's definitely a known phenomenon that happens. And what it says, to explain it, is that you have, say, two photons that are initially together. They're both created together, and one goes off one way and the other goes off the other way, and they get separated by a big distance. But then you do a measurement on A, and the result in quantum mechanics, most measurements have probabilistic results. Let's say, for example, if there's two possibilities and maybe you've got 50-50 chance of getting either result. Well, if you get result A on the first particle, you get a correlated result on the second particle. It depends what type of correlation exists, but say if you get A on one, maybe you get B on the other. Or if you get B on the first one, then you get A on the other. But in any case, the thing that happens at the first particle determines what happens at the second particle. So they're far enough away, for instance, that it may not be possible to get a light signal between them, between the two determinations of what's happening with them. But yet, they are correlated, so that's called non-locality. Well, the thing about that in physics, you can't transmit a signal. That follows from the equations of quantum mechanics itself, and there were a number of proofs in the 1980s by physicists published in the literature. The proofs are not even that long, maybe one page, to show that you can't transmit a signal, even though these correlations do occur. And I won't explain why, because that's more complicated, but anyway, you can't. However, it's tempting to look at it and say, well, here we have ESP happening, and we've got information transmitted from one point to another in psi, and we don't know that it's instantaneous, particularly in psi, because there's no way to determine that. I mean, when ESP comes to the brain, there's about a one-second processing time that seems to be revealed by physiological measurements. So there's no way to know if psi is instantaneous, but it's very fast, and it doesn't seem to depend on distance. So it's appealing to say, well, look, here is this relationship, and couldn't it be that ESP is taking place via quantum non-locality? Well, that isn't exactly the same as quantum mechanics, which says there can't be any signal, meaning there can't be any information transfer. But then again, you say, well, we know if you add consciousness, something's going to be different, and you're going to have a radical extension. So why not just say, fine, in psi you can transmit the signal that you can't do without consciousness. So it's a popular theory, and it's reasonable. There are other theories. For instance, Russell Targ and Elizabeth Rauscher have a theory in which space has extra dimensions that work to place one point of psi next to the other point where the information is received at psi, and in this greater complex space you get this connection. So they don't need to invoke quantum non-locality. They have a separate explanation. So this is just to point out, quantum non-locality isn't the only explanation, and we don't know which is the right one. It's too soon to know. But it is quite a viable candidate for explaining information transmission in ESP.
Excellent. Great. And again, to kind of back up a bit, you, I think, go over that point and make it quite well in your very excellent article that is a part of Psi Wars, and that is What is Beyond the Edge of the Known World, which is your contribution, along with being the editor for Psi Wars. So let's back up, because you spoke there quite eloquently and quite scientifically, but almost as if the issue of psi has been settled. And as we know, it is not at all settled. Where would you put the current state of our understanding of psi, whether it exists, from a research, from a scientific perspective? Where are we at right now?
Well, I think the easiest way to answer that is to give a range of where we might be, and I we don't even know where we are in this possible range. But one possibility is to go back to the emergentists who want minimal changes to physical law when we bring up the possibility of consciousness or psi. According to that, there's just consciousness, and if you want to add psi, maybe you add a little bit. You could argue there is no PK and find ways to get around that. This has been done in the parapsychology literature, and it's not completely resolved. Most parapsychologists feel PK is a real phenomenon, it does exist. But there have been arguments that, well, there is no PK and no mental action, and it's actually just ESP. So that would be a very simple addition, in which case we wouldn't be perhaps that far from understanding psi. On the other end of the range, let's say that, and this would be more like a model, for instance, done by physicist Saul Sirag. Sirag points out that all the properties of the physical world can be summed up in a few symmetry properties that underlie matter. So it's known, in fact, that the mathematical space that underlies space and other properties that are new and different, the properties in common would be time, but not space. This is one thing that's known. And that sort of fits. It makes sense. In consciousness, our time aligns with the time of the physical world, but yet thoughts don't exist in space. So you could say, well, maybe it's something like that, that psi has, it takes on the properties of the physical world and uses them, but it has these additional properties, and we don't yet understand what they are. I like to make a comparison to water that's in a pitcher, and the water takes on the shape of the pitcher, but it has its own properties too. And in taking on the shape of the pitcher, it'd be like our consciousness following what's in the brain as to content. But at the same time, we have these other properties that account for psi. In that case, we have to say we're pretty clueless as to what these properties are. And we can argue, well, that's what makes it so hard to understand psi. We could replicate it better if we knew, you know, it depends on this property and this, and do the same thing each time. But we don't know which things are the important things that we need to make sure are the same. In that case, we've got this whole realm opening up in front of us, and it can be quite an addition to physics because it will explain properties of consciousness and how these relate to the physical world, but we really haven't gotten there yet.
And what about the other position? What about the pretty vocal skeptical community out there that just calls bunk on the whole thing? Are we from a scientific standpoint past that point of saying, no, we really do have some good data from some experiments that really kind of put the case to bed in terms of there is some phenomena there?
Well, I see it as an example that's sometimes given about signal detection theory. And if you have a noisy signal, there's this issue, and the signal is faint, there's this issue, at what point are you getting an actual signal and you're sure you're getting it, and you're not just reading something into it, and at what point are you just reading into what is actually random noise and trying to get a signal out of it when there isn't anything? Let's say that signal is kind of important because it would be comparably to psi. You know, if psi is real, as in my personal opinion, it's real, that means we've got this whole new physics that is out there waiting for us to discover. It's really exciting. And so the parapsychology attitude is, well, we've got a faint signal, that's true. And you can't always replicate experiments that you thought you were going to replicate. And we don't have any physical theory that anybody agrees on. As I said, we have theories, plural, but none that's agreed that that's the, in fact, theory that we should have. So here we've got this important signal we think is coming through. And what do you do? The parapsychologist attitude is, well, this is exciting, and, well, yeah, conceivably there might be something we haven't thought of that really isn't a signal of this new findings after all, But it's so important. Let's go in and try to find what we can. This is exciting. We're willing to take the risk. The skeptic says, well, look, you don't know that there's a real signal there, and if it isn't there, you're wasting all your time. You know, so the skeptic says, well, you know, it takes extraordinary evidence to support extraordinary claims. When you've totally nailed down that that's your phenomenon, then we'll believe it. But the thing is, if there is something to discover, it's the parapsychologists that are going to be making all these discoveries. By the time the skeptics say, yes, it's definite and I agree with it, all the discoveries are made.
That's a good point, and it's a point that's made in this clip that I wanted to get your response to, but I'm going to play it anyway. It's from Michael Shermer, who I'm sure you're familiar with and our audience is probably familiar with. Very well-known, well-respected, very likable guy that I talked to, I had on the show, and a writer for Scientific America magazine. I wanted to play this clip and then get your response.
The standards that parapsychology are held to and should be held to are no different from anything else, any other claim in science, any science. That's just the way science is done. Although there is one proviso that, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. In the case of the paranormal research, you know, they're making some pretty spectacular claims that, if true, would really overturn, you know, the way science understands the world to be. So that's why they feel picked on, like somehow we're holding them to special standards. We're not. It's the same standards everybody else is held to. It's just that people pay closer attention because the results are pretty important.
Any thoughts on that, Dr. Burns?
Sure. He's quite right. The implications are pretty important. And, you know, it's a matter of whether you want to be exploratory or whether you want to be sure that they are important results. They won't really overturn physics, but they will make an important extension to physics.
And what about the a priori that you mentioned before? I mean, it does seem a little bit out of, you know, so much of what Dr. Shermer there sounds so logical and so straightforward, and yet the way that gets operationalized, there is no monolithic scientific community. And the way that we just look at the way parapsychology has been marginalized, there really is no explanation for it, just given the very sober description that you gave. This is fundamentally, critically important that we understand whether it exists or not. Why would it be such a taboo subject, and so marginalized within the scientific community? I mean, that doesn't really add up, and it kind of makes me question the real agenda that's going on with the skeptic community.
Well, part of it is just that people do their own research, and it's based on the idea that physics is a certain way, and but then you start wondering if there's something that's different out there. Will it overturn it? I've been saying, no, it won't overturn it, but that isn't always very clear to people. And they feel like, well, how can I do my research if the whole basis of what I'm doing, the physics, which I may not know that much about, you know, they'll be thinking that, you know, it's based on that. And if that gets overturned, where am I left? So it's the same thing with free will. Free will, the idea that free will exists is not popular. There's very few people actually that even propose it. I did a review in 99 and there weren't that many people. A few philosophers, a few physicists, a few others. But there's not that many people that even propose that free will acts. So I think part of it is just not wanting to get into the unknown, wanting to keep at least a basic framework where you're sure you understand what's going on. And then sometimes they feel that psi will be used to justify certain theological positions, and it is, you know, in the popular literature, that is done. And the skeptics react to that often, I think, by saying, wait a minute, I don't want theology specified to me just because psi exists.
Sure, but the flip side of that, of course, is that the atheistic academic paradigm that really kind of has pervaded for so long because it, and understandably, because it overthrew the religious theological paradigm, which needed to be overthrown, but that new paradigm has some major holes in it too, just in terms of atheism is another religion. It can't be proved. Its basic tenets are non-scientific in that they kind of state something that can't be reversed. So, you know, we're kind of stuck in between. On one hand, we have we live in a country that has a very fundamentalist Christian perspective that kind of pervades the media. And on the other side, we have an atheistic academic paradigm. And I think we kind of don't know which way to go. But, the other thing I'd say is we also have a social taboo against, we can say that we're open to God and all that, but anything that begins to look like spirituality that comes out of the academic community, we really have a very narrow box that we can fit that in.
Well, that's true. I think one thing that's relevant here is that, ultimately, I think we will get back to more acceptance in the intellectual part of our culture for theological ideas. But I think what's got to happen first is religion has a certain amount of doctrines, any religion, and you go to people who are connected to the theological aspect of any religion nowadays, and there's this concern, are we compatible with science? Are we making some claim about the beginning of the world or the nature of human experience or whatever it is that's compatible with science? Because if it's not, people are not going to accept it, and we're going to have to make some sort of adjustment here. And what I notice is that theologians are just now getting into this, and I think once they square off themselves and ask, how is theology connected to what we know of science, and is it compatible, and straighten out all of the questions that are now being looked into, then we can all breathe a sigh of relief and say, okay, then spirituality is shown it's compatible with science. Then it's a matter of saying, well, is spirituality itself something that exists? And I think then people will realize that's basically a leap of faith. You can't prove the existence of God from a science experiment. Not if you define God to be infinite.
Right, but I think you're much more optimistic than I am about how that meeting in the middle can happen. I mean, I think the theologians are completely hamstrung with the dogma that they bring to the table. They're only going to come to any kind of understanding that it's kind of from the top down, no pun intended, from their holy enshrined scripture that it's mythology. I mean, we've pretty much established that. The question is whether at the core there is some essence of truth that science might point to. But I just don't see them coming to that middle ground.
Actually, Alex, it is happening in small groups. But for instance, well, I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, and right in Berkeley, there's the Center for Theology and Natural Sciences. And the person who founded that group is a theologian who has a PhD in physics. And they bring people in who are trying to examine how spirituality relates to contemporary physics. So there is a small group of people that really are working on it. We just don't hear about them much.
Well, I definitely agree with that last part. I think the whole... I think that journey is ultimately a personal journey, and how you feel about, which is, I think, your point, if that meeting in the middle, though, can happen. Because the atheistic academic paradigm has served us well. It's served us well as a way of kind of moving past all the theological weight that held back science for so long. So I don't know. Do you see any kind of shift away from that paradigm?
I've seen a shift since the late 90s that there's more interest in how spirituality and science come together. It's a small group working on it, but I feel that shift is there. I don't know how long it will take.
You know, one thing I've kind of thought for a while, and I haven't seen anyone really delve into this except maybe Rupert Sheldrake, but that's that I think even psi research has been hamstrung by this paradigm. And I recently heard Sheldrake, and his point was, you know, why has so much psi research kind of approached the whole subject with one arm tied behind its back? I mean, let's get people randomly off the street. Let's get college students. When what we're really, when we look at the natural history of psi that's been reported through the ages across cultures, what it really tells us is psi happens when people have a love relate, when there's love, when there's this deeper connection, this spiritual connection among people, psi happens. And we all hear the stories from within our family of the sisters who knew when the other one was injured or passed away or all these things. And yet, I think it's striking that the huge body of parapsychology and psi research has almost ignored any kind of close attachment or bond or love between people. And I think that's changing a little bit. But isn't that a relic of this need to kind of fit into this paradigm that doesn't acknowledge that?
Well, I see the arrows as going in both directions. The parapsychologists want to do good science, so they stick with the concepts that are currently in science. And those don't include very much description of things like love. At least if you look at like spiritual descriptions of love, you get into a whole different vocabulary. It goes into transpersonal psychology, which is about the only field that really deals with this. That you can talk about love and say, well, there's love that for instance wants the company of the person, because then they're not lonely anymore, and so you're in a dualistic kind of thing. And then you get into this vocabulary, you can also have a love which flows from a center which is open and joyous, and in this center we're all connected. And there you're in a spiritual language. You're just not in a language that has been incorporated into the regular psychology. And probably, I agree with you. I'm going to say probably because it isn't definitely known, but to me, very probably, psi will end up being described in terms of a more spiritual language. And we're just not at that point. And that probably impedes us. I'm speculating, of course, here, but probably if we understood the right language in which to view psi, it would look more like a spiritual language.
Interesting. You know, how about the way that psi has started to find its way under a different name into other disciplines? I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Psi in biology, where we look at schools of fish and we say, gee, there's no way that this thousandth fish in the back corner of the school could possibly know that the fish in the front has turned right, and yet when we observe them on film, they're all turning and they have some kind of appear to have some kind of collective intelligence. And we see it in insects where, gosh, we've known this for so long, but termites and ants and bees, they don't even exist if not as a whole, as a hive, as a colony. And any thoughts on that? Or the way that psi maybe has started to show up in medical research and therapeutic touch, which is obviously very controversial, but other areas of medicine. So is psi making its way into other fields of research? And of course, consciousness research is one that I left out. And is it making its way under a different name? And is that going to kind of, will it ultimately undermine parapsychology, or does it reinforce and support parapsychology?
Well, I haven't really seen that much of that type of experiment to say that, you know, there's any big movement where psi is entering other fields. But to the extent it is, I think you just go on doing good science and find out whatever you find out. I don't see that at this point as being a big contributor to psi. I see that more as what parapsychologists per se are doing.
What about in the medical area? Do you see any of the prayer research or the therapeutic touch research or intent research being significant at this point?
I think they still have to go further on just working out their methodologies. So I think it's just early days. It probably will be important once they get that going.
Okay. Could you tell us, Dr. Burns, a little bit about the book, Psy Wars, which you were one of the co-editors of? What will the reader find in that? What was your purpose in terms of putting it together, and what has been the response so far?
Well, probably the most interesting part is how long it took for us to do it. It took about 9 years for us to get this book out. And it was something the editors wanted to do from the beginning, but there was so much controversy that the editors, I was the only editor that knew anything much about parapsychology, and the others, some of them knew some of the skeptic literature, but didn't know any of the parapsychology literature. So we went through various ideas on how to do the book, and at one point we had a group of four people as editors, but we as a group, the editors of Journal of Consciousness Studies work collaboratively, and we never really got it together exactly what we wanted, so it ended up that the four editors we originally had never got the book together either. And then finally, Anthony Freeman, our managing editor, asked Jim Alcock if he would be editor, and he agreed, and he did a fabulous job. And I asked if I could be one of the editors, and Anthony agreed with that. So we put out notices to skeptic groups and to parapsychology bulletin board, and I sent emails to various parapsychologists that I knew. And so the articles basically are just whoever wanted to contribute and send in an abstract. Among the abstracts we got, we picked out a group to make up the issue. So the articles are basically that. They're somewhat of a sampling of the skeptic thought and the parapsychology thought, with about half of each type of article. So what you get in the book is just the sampling of the current ideas from both sides. And it was meant to inform people in multidisciplinary fields, in a variety of fields, in other words, what is going on in parapsychology and what the controversies are and how the skeptics see it and how the parapsychologists see it, so that they could read through it and get a sense of what's going on. So that was the book. It's a special issue of Journal of Consciousness Studies, and it's also published as a book called Psy Wars.
And Dr. Burns, can you tell us a little bit about your theories, maybe that aren't covered in the book, do a much better job of explaining in a way that we can all understand some of your theories as they relate to psi research?
Sure. I felt it was important to look at the possibility that psi takes place within the limits of the uncertainty principle. That idea wasn't original with me. It was first used by Evan Harris Walker, a physicist, beginning 1975 and maybe even earlier. But I felt it was important to carry forward this whole idea. And the way I use it is somewhat different from E.H. Walker. He had a collapse of the wave function theory that he incorporated with this idea, whereas what I do is say, well, the main changes that you're going to get in matter, if you're within the limits of the uncertainty principle, are going to be in molecules because they're very lightweight, and you can have more change in something that has a light weight. So the whole thing is these changes within the uncertainty principle are very small, and if you're going to get any kind of meaningful change out of it, there has to be some means of magnification. So what I did is show that interactions between molecules magnify these changes. If you don't have the action of consciousness, these changes are random. It's just the effects of quantum fluctuations. And in the case of energy and momentum, in the long term, it averages out to zero. But if you say, well, consciousness can order these changes, then these ordered changes can be magnified. And what I've done is shown that you can account for the magnitudes of psi changes in that way. So it becomes a viable hypothesis. So it's a possible means of in the way that psi can work and affect matter. And yet at the same time, because it's within the limits of the uncertainty principle, it wouldn't affect other measurements that are controlled in laboratories. And so it explains, if we have psi, why is it that it doesn't wreck our physics experiments? The answer is then the quantum fluctuation changes are controlled for, and so they never would get magnified and get big enough to change your experiment.
You know, I mean, the takeaway for me, that is over my head in a lot of different ways, but the real takeaway for me is that, you know, here's some serious, serious work that's being done by a serious scientist to try and tackle this issue in a very scientific way. I mean, what I hear you saying is, hey, given the theories that we have, how would psi possibly fit in, as you've explained before? I mean, could it be non-locality? Well, here are some theories for that. Could it be the uncertainty principle? Here are some theories how that should work. And it just sounds like a very reasonable way to approach this topic. And I guess the only reason I bring that up is, gosh, what I hear from the skeptical community is just, it's just so disappointing, because the impression that you're left with is that no one worth a darn would be in this field, would be looking at any of this, because it just doesn't exist. And I think the point that you made before is really the key point, is it's so important, if it does exist, that we have our brightest people working on it. And gosh, we know there isn't any money in it, and there isn't going to be any money in it. But the implications are so important, it sure seems like a shame to not put our best effort in trying to understand this phenomenon.
Yeah, I agree. It's important that we try and understand it.
Anything else that you'd like to add before we wrap it up today?
No, that's fine.
Okay, well, thanks again for joining us, Dr. Jean Burns, one of the co-editors of the very, very great book, explains psi from both perspectives, of a skeptical perspective and from a parapsychologist perspective. And that book, again, you'll find a link to on our website. Thanks again, Dr. Burns.
You're welcome.
I'd like to thank Dr. Burns again for joining us today. If you'd like more information about the book, Psi Wars, or any of the other subjects we talked about, please be sure to check out our show notes at the Skeptico website. That's skeptiko.com. And always continue to think about us when you're writing reviews or blogging or whatever else you might be doing to get the word out. Thanks, and bye for now.